Little did I think, 2 weeks ago as I was boarding an MAF plane with our family from Nankundi that we would be with you this morning. The last couple of months have been quite different for us all, to say the least. You can perhaps reading some blurbs about events in Zaire, but they've been pretty much relegated to the back pages of newspapers. When peace talks are going on in Madrid and so on, people evacuating from Zaire are far less important. But we are thankful for your prayers. We realize that if we are here today and if we've made the decision to leave, it's because of the prayers of many who have confirmed that this is the step that we should take. We don't know for how long. We are hopeful of returning, but we don't know for sure the conditions of the country, whether they will permit us to go back in January or whenever. But let me just give you a bit of an update on the situation. For those of you who haven't been able to get all the details, Zaire is a fantastically rich country, the richest country in Africa, but for the last 26 years it's been systematically pillaged by those in authority and have left the country completely a basket case with absolutely no resources and in debt and impoverished, and yet those in authority have become very, very rich. The United States and other governments have supported this regime for many years, but more recently I've realized that the goal of preventing communism from spreading in Africa is no longer a valid one, and so they've withdrawn their support, and now those in authority are seeking to continue on at all costs, but their days are very, very numbered. We really don't understand the politics of the country as we should. Being outsiders, we can't really appreciate all that's been going on, but for about 4 months now there have been efforts in Kinshasa to try to bring about a democratic, multi-party election for the first time in the history of the country. These have been systematically thwarted, and as of today, the conference was supposed to have started again, but we have no idea whether things will really result in the change of government as needed. The President Mobutu is due to leave office on the 4th of December. So when we talk about December and waiting and seeing until December, it's because we don't know what will happen after the 4th of December. There should be a transition to another government, but if this is not possible and he shows no signs of being willing to relinquish power and authority, then the situation could erupt at any time into a bloodbath. We saw evidence of this on the 23rd of September and 24th. There was a terrible looting in Kinshasa, the capital. You probably did finally hear about Zaire at that time when riots worsened during the years of independence in the 60s and the rebellion to follow literally destroyed the most of the capital. Homes were completely looted. We had some freight down there that was taken, but that's very minor in comparison to the families who lost absolutely everything. Homes just completely looted, toilets taken out, and everything else. Just unbelievable, the things that were going on. Fortunately, very few killings. MAF, Mission Aviation Fellowship, based in Nankundi, endured heavy losses there in Kinshasa, and as they were reevaluating their situation later, they decided that they would leave Nankundi as well, with just one plane and pilot base there, and so at that time we had to think about leaving. The prime minister delegate of the country was nominated as a means of trying to produce calm after this problem in Kinshasa was sacked after 2 days when he refused to pledge allegiance to Mobutu and not to the country. And we really don't know what's going to happen. He's very popular. He's very much appreciated by the people in general, but he's not able to get into power. Then there really is not much hope for a change in that country. there were recent riots in Lubumbashi, the capital to the south, about 1,500 miles south of us. We talk about Kinshasa being 1,500 miles to the southwest and Lubumbashi 1,500 miles to the south, and all in the same country, you realize that great distances and terrible roads separate us from areas where there were problems. But all around us, and there were signs that this could take place even in our part of the country, the American embassy strongly advised that all Americans leave the country. The Belgians provided transport even into Bunia, our nearest town, to evacuate us. When you hear on BBC radio that all Americans should leave, and there's a plane coming to get you in Bunia the next day, it makes you begin to wonder whether you should stay or not. Well, we had our MEF planes there, and they arranged a very orderly evacuation. We were one of the ones to leave on Saturday 2 weeks ago, and by now everyone is out but about four people. At Yinkundi, there are a couple of McDowells and Bert Mest. We're up at Itende when we left, but I think even they may decide to leave after a bit. So how should we pray? 35 or more people left, but 35 million people can't leave. So I think we really need to be praying for those Christians, those in the country who have to stay and who are praying fervently that there would be a change in government, that peace and calm could return, that the economic conditions and so on that have caused and sparked so much of this discontent could be alleviated. We realize there are many here that are wondering about our future, and we wish we could give you more information, but we have to wait and see what happens in December. We just had furlough a year ago. We hope to go back in January if things are calm. Others who are able to stay on can perhaps take an early furlough and go back later as the situation is possible. But I would ask you to pray, just as we were reading this verse this morning, Isaiah 40, 23, who brings the princes to nothing. We heard about Khrushchev, and we need to be praying for those in authority there in Zaire, that the Lord would bring them to nothing, that they would change their hearts like he did Nebuchadnezzar's, and who, if they are not willing to be, to change, to be removed by him.
Thank you, Bob. We appreciate that report. As he has said, we can be praying for the many missionaries that had to leave, but we have to remember the many millions of people that cannot leave. I would like to switch our attention from Africa over to the Western Hemisphere. We're very happy to have Ron Harris from Mexico with us this morning for our interview. I'm going to start by asking Ron to tell us a little bit about his family and then how he got the call to the Lord's service and how he got the call to Mexico.
Those are a lot of questions. Let me start the family part of the story exactly 100 years ago. In May of 1891, my grandfather left Great Britain to come to Mexico to serve the Lord. His wife died that very year. In November, she was buried, leaving him with one daughter. He remarried 4 or 5 years later. He married a very close friend of his wife's. She wrote letters to his wife, not knowing she had passed away. My grandfather answered the letters. Correspondence over the years led Fanny Hatherley to come here to New York, then to go by train alone to San Antonio. And in the British consulate in San Antonio, she married my grandfather. 4 boys and a girl were married as a result of that union. Aunt Nett, my father John, and my uncle William stayed on in Mexico serving the Lord. 2 of the brothers returned to England. 1 was a school teacher in Weston-super-Mare. The other was a banker in London, near London. My father had 3 children. My father was born in 1900. I'm the eldest, born in 1928. A sister born 3 years later, and a brother born 10 years later. My brother and I are still serving the Lord in Mexico. My sister married my brother-in-law. We traded. I married Dorothy Howard, son of Charles S. Howard, born in Liverpool, raised in Boston, but spent most of his life in the Chicago area. One of his sons married my sister. I think the latter part of the question was, what was my call to Mexico? It wasn't automatic. I was born in Mexico. I'm a Mexican citizen, so I have all the liberty in the world to serve the Lord in Mexico, which foreigners still do not have. They have limitations. As a Mexican citizen, I have none of them. But I repeat, it was not automatic. I would have gone to England to study, but because of the First World War, I came to study in the States, in Florida for 4 years, Hampton Bowes Academy. My last year, I happened to room with Dr. Edmund's son, and he really twisted my arm and talked me into studying at Wheaton College. I met my wife not at Wheaton College, but at Lombard Gospel Chapel, where I attended the 4 years that I was in Lombard. I wanted to study theology. As far as my sophomore year, those were my plans. And I think they were good plans. Oil was discovered in Mexico. A career in geology would have been very profitable, very interesting. And I fully intended to serve the Lord with all my strength, with all the time, but I wanted to be self-supporting as a geologist. During my sophomore year, one Sunday afternoon, Jim Elliott, martyred in Ecuador, and I went to visit an elderly man, German man called Mr. Wagner. In the meeting, they announced that he was very sick, and I must admit, we were not in the habit of visiting the sick on a Sunday afternoon, but both Jim and I decided to do so. Mr. Wagner, on his bed, very weak, I think was a prophet, news of God, because he spoke to Jim, words that shaped Jim's future, and he spoke to me. He did not know anything about me, but he asked me two questions. One, do you believe God is able to save your soul? Do you believe God is able to take you to heaven? Without any hesitation, I said, sure, of course I do. Second question, why is it so difficult for a young man like you to trust God for material things? You're trusting Him with your life, with your spiritual well-being, with your eternal destiny. What's so hard about trusting Him to sustain your needs in your daily life? Quite a question to ask a sophomore in college. I thought I was very able to support myself. But he made me think, and over a period of a week maybe, I decided geology is not for me. I switched my major to anthropology and began preparing to return to Mexico as soon as my college days were over. I took a lot of courses in journalism. My idea was that anthropology was a wide background of information which might help me prepare, because I knew one of my ministries would be the printed page. Sorry I was so long.
That's quite all right. Very interesting. I'm sure everyone enjoyed hearing about that. You know now that he's related to Bob Howard, too. You mentioned that you're a citizen, so that you have no difficulties in there. But how do others get into Mexico as missionaries? I know they don't get in as missionaries, but just tell us a little bit about those that are down there that do not have Mexican citizenship.
There's basically three ways to get in. You can get in as a tourist. You have to leave every 6 months. You just go out and come right back in again, and for most people, there is no problem in doing that. Some, if they do it too often, too obviously, might eventually get into some kind of trouble. The law states that only Mexican nationals can hold a religious office. Now, being a missionary could be considered an office. Being the pastor of a church could be an office. But we don't function that way, so that is no problem at all to those that go down to serve the Lord. The other two ways are by investing in the country, or like Don Harris did. He worked in the country for Fairbanks Morse for a number of years. And when he retired, he took early retirement and stayed on in Mexico. Fairbanks Morse got him permanent residence while he was working for them.
We've seen an increase in the number of missionaries in Mexico recently, but most of them we know come from Texas and Colorado, so it's not too hard to take a quick trip home and then go back again. Now, you and your wife are both good writers. You took your course in journalism and all of that, and we've had one of your books for a long time, The Lord's Supper, from Everyday Publications, but recently your wife published a book called Open House, and you published one, My Cup Runneth Over. Could you tell us a little about each of these? What's in them?
Okay. Open House was really written for our children. The Lord has given us 5 children, 10 grandchildren, and for the last 4 years or so, Dad has been writing notes. We've been reading them back and forth, polishing them a little. We plan to mimeograph this and give it to the children and grandchildren for Christmas. But a number of visits with other missionaries, we don't travel too much, but a lot of very distinguished people have found their way into our home. And as we talked to people, particularly one young missionary couple, we realized that they were having a tremendous struggle deciding what was the main priority in their life, their family or their ministry. And they seemed to be having a tremendous conflict, not knowing how much time to give to one, depriving the other, or vice versa. We do not claim to have all the answers. Any blessing that we have seen in our family, and we are extremely thankful for 5 children that love the Lord and are very active in His service, and some grandchildren that are starting to do the very same thing. We don't claim to have a secret. It's just the grace of God. But the way the grace of God has been manifest to us, we thought might be a help to missionaries and to others who seem to have that conflict. What is the relationship between my ministry and my home? The book seeks to prove that it is God's purpose and it is God's grace that gives abundant resources for both. Both are important. There are 2 institutions that are divine in origin and wherein the purposes of God are centered today. One is the home. One is the local church. Those are the 2 institutions that Satan is attacking with all of his strength today. So one of the sides, or maybe the main thrust of the book, is that God's resources are sufficient for the home and for the assembly. The book is very biographical. It's very, very personal. We open our house and we open our hearts to you in the book. But we trust that the blend of the Lord's work and the home, actually they are hard to separate. You can't write about one in the beginning and about the other at the end of the book because they are completely intertwined. So that would be the purpose, the idea of Open House. They are very short essays in simple language. In the assembly in Lombard, most of the families have read this around the table to their children. And it has been really interesting to us to see the reaction of the different children as they come up and comment on some of the incidents that are mentioned in the book.
That book is the story of 40 years in the home life of a missionary. It's very interesting. The Harris has very kindly made it available to all the missionaries at the Conference for Missionaries last year. And I know they and we have had many letters saying what a blessing and the help it has been to them. That's been around a while. It's on the book table. And Brother Ron brought with him this book, The Supply of Those My Cup Runneth Over. Can you tell us what's in that?
Okay, My Cup Runneth Over is a book that is in its 2nd edition in Spanish. This is its 1st edition in English. It was printed by Redeemer Books, Winnemac, Indiana. This book contains 66 brief meditations on the person and the work of the Lord, one taken from each of the 66 books of the Bible. We often say that Christ is in all scriptures, but you might be put on the spot if somebody told you, what does Nahum say about Christ? What does Obadiah have to say about Christ? It's true. Christ is in all scriptures. Now, this book was written in Spanish to help our brethren to put a little more variety in their worship. Many times as we gather around the bread and the cup to remember the Lord, we kind of feel that we can read from the Passion account in the four Gospels. We can read from 1 Corinthians 11, maybe a verse or two in chapter 10. We can read from Isaiah 53. We can read from Psalm 22, but that's about all. The book seeks to illustrate practically how there can be worship in our hearts as we read about the person and the work of the Lord in every single book of the Bible. It's not a deep book. It has a blend of exposition and devotional thought. Its purpose is to try and make my cup run it over to be an experience in the reader. It's one of the many figures of speech that the Holy Spirit uses to describe worship. Worship is when our cup runs over after meditating on the greatness of our God, the gentleness, the kindness, the love of our shepherd.
Thank you, Ron. Now, in Mexico, you're involved in the Emmaus correspondence work, and there are two facets to that. There is the overall Spanish work, and there is the local work in Mexico. You tell us first about the overall Spanish work.
The overall Spanish work, for years, it has been our privilege and responsibility to publish. That means editing, translating most of the courses, keeping a supply in stock, and supplying those who use them in all of Latin America, Spain, Holland. You'll be surprised that Australia has quite a number of Spanish shepherds, and the school in Australia is a regular customer for courses in Spanish. We got involved in this by starting with a local school. When Dr. Harlow printed the first edition of What the Bible Teaches in Spanish, he printed 5,000 copies in Cuba. He's a man of vision. He picked 10 missionaries and sent each missionary 500 copies. When I got my 500 copies, of course I knew about Emmaus, and I had read the course. I'd even used it in a small way. I said to myself, I do not need 500 copies of What the Bible Teaches. I have enough to do. We were very much involved in printing work, printing gospel tracts, printing Sunday school materials. I just can't take this on. But they were in the way. Our home was very small. 500 courses take up quite a bit of room in one's living room. We had it in the garage, but the car just barely fit in the garage, so the courses had to come into the living room. We started using them, and I will confess, with very little enthusiasm. But as we used them, our enthusiasm began to build up. We saw that they were tremendously effective, that they were a tremendous tool. Many other ways of serving the Lord, you always have ballpark figures, you have round numbers. How many people hear the gospel in an open-air meeting? Pretty hard to pinpoint. Yet, in a correspondence course, someone has answered 120 questions. The information went in through his eyes and came out through his fingers. And they asked questions at the end. We were really getting to people. So, we were told. Again, that was the wisdom of God, because most of you know what happened in Cuba in 1959. Cuba would not have been a good center for distributing courses to the rest of the Spanish-speaking world. So we began with one course, and today we have 33 different titles in Spanish, which we print. We are trying to diversify. Paul Rogers in Argentine is going to be doing all the children's courses, and Peter Dillon in Cupertino, California is going to be doing all the prison courses. And we don't know what the future has in store, but I am sure it includes printing in a number of other countries now, because postage is so difficult and political uncertainties and a number of reasons seem to make it wise to not have all the printing done in one place anymore.
So basically all the overseas Spanish courses filter through your area. at the present time. What about the local correspondence work? Is that, well, you mentioned a little bit, but tell us a little more about it.
The local school started slowly. I have my figures in here, but figures can be very, very boring. The first year we sent out something like 244 courses, and we had about a 40% completion record, which was good. We built up slowly. To date, we've sent out well over 500,000, and our completion record still is close to the 40%. We don't do all the work in Mexico. We have 12 other sub-directors or directors in other regions. Postage being so slow, it is always better to have your courses corrected as close as possible to where you live. And with the help of 11 others, we have somewhere around 30,000 current students. Our office handles maybe a sixth of it. One other school is about the same size as ours, and the others are a little smaller.
How is what is the funding method for the Emmaus correspondence courses? Emmaus doesn't, college in Dubuque doesn't fund it all. How is this financed and carried on?
Some of the wisdom that God gave the founders of Emmaus is to make Emmaus be as decentralized as possible. Anyone who works with Emmaus courses does so under his own responsibility. We do receive help once in a while from, used to be Oak Park, now it's Dubuque, but we don't count on it. The Lord has provided marvelously. Bookkeeping was definitely not one of my, one of my hobbies, one of my pleasures. But it has become so. Because every year as we close the books, those books spoke eloquently of God's grace, God's graciousness, God's provision. We have never made a profit. Our losses have been very small. There has always been enough to cover the growing expense of circulating that many courses. Most of our courses are for believers now. We have six titles that are gospel courses. Those have always been and always will be given out to students free of charge. The courses that are for believers are sold. They are sold at prices that will shock you. In English, you pay $4, $6 for an Emmaus course. In Spanish, you never go over the equivalent of a dollar. Our postage is very high, yet the course is sold to Christians, bring in enough, along with gifts from assemblies in Mexico, assemblies in the States. Much of the money that is given to us is channeled into Emmaus courses. Just to give you an idea of the size of the ministry, keep that. We just got a bill the 10th of October 1991 from our printer. The bill is for $90,480. And this covers printing done in 3 years, not counting stationery, diplomas, receipts. And since this printer couldn't keep up with the amount of printing that we have been doing, we now have another printer in Puebla who is printing a similar amount of courses. So that's the quantity of money that's involved.
Now you have ample evidence that the Lord provides.
Yes, we do.
Tell us something about the culture in Mexico in the various parts of the country as compared to the United States.
Well, the one thing I would like to get across is that Mexico is a country that has different cultures, different climates, very varied. You cannot generalize and say Mexico is like this and paint one picture. Mexico has 30 states. The United States of America has 50. Mexico has a great variety of climates. The bulk of the population lives in the plateau, anywhere from 5,000 to 7,000 feet. So we do not know great extremes of heat and cold weather. That's geography. The question had to do with the culture of the people. Anthropologists recognize at least 7 different types of people in Mexico. Let's stop at the top. If you met a Mexican businessman in an airport, Newark Airport or any other airport in the United States, you probably couldn't tell him apart from anybody else. He has a suit, he has a briefcase, he has a desktop computer, and he's running about like crazy, arranging business deals here and there. We have people in Mexico, and a lot of them that are incredibly wealthy. Mexico is a prodigious country in production of minerals. It has a shoreline with a lot of fishing. Yet it's a country that is very poor. Mexico's problem is graft, corruption.
Sounds like that, yeah.
Exactly the same. My heart feels for Zaire because it's the problem of Mexico and all the rest of Latin America too. But we have that kind of people. At the bottom of the rung, not in God's eyes, but in men's eyes, we have people that still live in the mountains. They still speak a dialect that has nothing to do with Spanish. As far as they're concerned, Columbus never discovered America, and Cortes never came and conquered it. They live very much like they did years and years ago. In between, you have all kinds of grades. You have people that are just coming out from the mountains, from the jungles, and the government is trying to get them out. Mexico has a tremendous alphabetization campaign. Everybody in the country has to read, and they have to read Spanish. So the differences are being minimized. The bulk of the people are people that have a mixed ancestry. It's a mixture of Indian blood, Spanish blood, African blood. There's a lot of immigration in Mexico. We have a lot of Lebanese, a lot of Arabs, a lot of Japanese, a lot of Chinese. In the country I was, in the town where I was brought up, we had Japanese doctors, Italian hardware store people, Spaniards that ran factories, and most of these people keep a close connection to their original roots. So we're painting a picture that has a lot of variety in it.
Speaking of these varieties, when you're going out with the gospel, do you use different methods for different groups, or have you found one basic approach the best to use just to get started talking to them?
Okay, we have a message that is the same for all, Christ and Him crucified. But obviously, there are differences in the way of presenting it. Even Emmaus courses. We have some that we feel are suitable for university students. My brother particularly has done a lot of work in university circles. Men Who Met the Master, Thy Word is Truth, and most of the commentaries on New Testament books, they are written in fairly simple Spanish, but they are very adequate. Because somebody can be an eminence in chemistry, but he knows nothing about theology, so it's just as well to keep things simple, even for university students. Then we have just a few courses that are very, very simple. The Bible Tells Me So would be an example. Many think that that course is for children, but it is not. That course was originated, the idea for it at least, in Mexico, and the course is geared to barely literate adults. Adults who, when they are on the second sentence they're reading, have completely forgotten what the first one said. So it's very dangerous to use pronouns. They don't know what the pronoun is about. You have to write different, you have to keep things short, very, very simple. And when you're teaching, when you're preaching, you have to do the same thing. The Bible is a marvelous book, though. The Bible, part of God's wisdom is presenting truth in a cultural setting that is understandable by any culture in the world. Illustrations taken from nature, the sower and the seed. You don't have to simplify or translate into another culture. That can be understood by anybody.
Would you say, or have we heard, that Mexico City is on its way to being the largest city in the world?
It would be almost impossible to count. Most people think Mexico City has now over 20 million inhabitants, but they are pouring in at the rate of almost 100,000 a day, and not that many people are leaving. Although anybody with any brains would.
There are some popular resort areas in Mexico too, aren't there?
Yes. Tourism is one of Mexico's biggest industries. They call it the industry that doesn't pollute, the industry without chimneys. And almost every president, the last 10 or so, each one has started one resort somewhere in Mexico. The newest is one in Huatulco Bay, on the Pacific side.
Is there any Christian activity in these areas where these resorts are, or is it just left to the world?
There is a little. I'm glad you asked that question, because that's the newest information about Mexico that we have. In Acapulco, other groups have done considerable work in presenting the gospel. One or two of the big hotels in Acapulco have Christian Bible studies. They have some kind of a preaching meeting in a convention center in a hotel. This has been going on for quite a number of years. We got a letter just last week that three couples from our assembly, two doctors and an accountant, went to visit a young couple from our assembly that went to Huatulco Bay. They went commended by the assembly in Tehuacan as missionaries. They are not working with the tourists. They are working in the small town just off the tourist resort, where most of the workers in the resort would live. Other Christians had moved to the town, two or three families from Orizaba. Men in our assembly who paints murals had been doing a job in one of the big hotels in Huatulco. And on Sunday, he wandered around this little town trying to find believers. He found a small group of believers meeting in a home, and they just pled with him to come again, to teach them. They were new Christians, they knew nothing, and they were utterly alone, no other Christian witness at all, in the town called Santa Cruz, Huatulco. This was after we left Mexico in July. Came back to the assembly and presented the need. A couple that were just married in May, she teaches dressmaking, and he is a civil engineer. He teaches computer science in a school. Both of them decided we will go. And within a week, they went and started looking for work. He found work teaching, and so did she. And they've been working there. They report that there are at least 12 couples that are now saved and needing to break bread. And we are so delighted that the assembly has not only commended them, but it's a long trip. It's about a 12-hour trip over very dangerous mountain highways. But this last weekend, three couples went to visit them and not only helped them financially. They need financial help because they have to start from scratch. They have nothing. Both of them are working, but both of them limited their teaching hours, he to 21, she to 10, so that they would have ample time to serve the Lord and to teach. Yet as teachers, they have a real significant contact with the people, which is a plus when it comes to opening up a new area.
Thank you. A little different slant. Are you acquainted with this brother that's commended from assembly in Mexico that's in Albania? Lebrado Salgado?
I have heard of him. I do not know him personally.
Your brother?
I do know of some. There's quite a few Mexican believers that have worked with OM in different parts of the world.
This fellow went out from, I can't speak Spanish, to wherever, O.C. Thames area.
Yes, Baja California.
And he was staying in Italy and making periodic trips into Albania for the last several years. You heard from him about once a year. But lately, he has moved into Albania and is giving out the gospel there. Do you have any advice? I know we have one or two people in our audience, young people, who are exercised about the mission field and serving the Lord. Any brief advice you could give them? I know you could counsel them for hours, but some general guidelines or thoughts, way to direct their thinking?
Don't think of missions as something in the future. Think of missionary service as something very, very present. You will never do abroad what you are not doing in your own assembly, in your own community. It is so easy to leave an assembly in New Jersey and go to an assembly in Bolivia, let's say, and just continue doing the very same thing. You can be faithful in attendance at meetings, you can lead the singing, you can teach, you can speak once in a while. I think missionary work is not changing your address. Missionary work is much more than crossing geographical boundaries. You have to be crossing now the boundaries between faith and unbelief, between knowledge of God and ignorance of God. And those boundaries are right here. In my mentality as someone who was born and brought up in Mexico, home base is not so much a given country. I feel that home base is the local assembly, wherever it is. And the mission field is across the street and next door. So I think that mentality would help a young missionary immensely, because he would be doing here and proving he can do here that which he will have to do when he goes abroad.
Is it important for the new missionary to know the language of the country where they're going?
Yes, tremendously important. Second to Bible knowledge comes knowledge of the language. And I don't only mean the grammar. You have to know the thinking, the idiosyncrasies of people that speak that language. My advice to missionaries that know where they are going is to study intensively, as much as they can, the language and the culture of the place they are going to. And this doesn't necessarily mean university students. You can go to the consulate of the country you're interested in. You can subscribe to newspapers that are printed in the country you're going to. You can start to get acquainted with the literature, both the classical and the contemporary literature of the country you're going to. And this pays off. You can start studying the scriptures in the language of the country you're going to. You can memorize scriptures in that language. You can memorize hymns in that language. The sooner you start, the better. Because the younger you are, the easier it is to learn the language.
We had a brother in the office the other day. He and his wife have gone over to Romania for a visit, looking forward to perhaps serving the Lord there. And he had met some Brother Shantov from Canada at the Homeworkers Conference up there in Terre Haute. And Brother Shantov said he was going to, I forget it was Hungary or Yugoslavia, and the way he was preparing, he had gotten the Bible in the language of that country, and he was doing his daily Bible reading in English and then followed up by the other country. So Brother Beverly got himself a Romanian Bible, and that's what he's doing. He does his daily Bible reading, once in English and once in Romanian, and he said he was amazed at how much of the language he was picking up already. In the Spanish countries, hasn't there been difficulty sometime with people going over to Spain and learning Castilian Spanish and then finding it useless in South America?
I think that's an exaggeration. Okay. Useless doesn't describe it. We had no trouble at all understanding Brother Nathan, and he speaks
Scotch.
Scotch.
It's just the language of heaven.
That's exactly what happens in Mexico, in Latin America. Spain pronounces words a little bit different. Spain assigns specific meanings to words that would not be the same in Latin America. But then in the northern part of the hemisphere, in Mexico, for instance, we have a very strong influence from Mexican dialects in a lot of our Spanish words. Obviously, those words will not be understood in the southern part of the hemisphere, nor would Inca words be understood in Mexico. But that's just a very small part of the language that gives it color. Reader's Digest has no problem. The same edition of Reader's Digest is distributed to all the Spanish-speaking world. The only thing that changes from country to country is the advertising.
Mm.
And then mass media, television, radio programs, transmission of soccer games, that's made for everybody, for Spain, for Latin America. So that as time goes by, a common denominator is being formed. And differences that were very notable 50 years ago are not that important today. The whole world is speaking the same brand of Spanish now.
Half of this country, too.
Yeah, that's true.
I know you're planning on returning to Mexico soon, so perhaps in the few moments that are left, you could tell us something of your future plans, your immediate future plans, and perhaps some prayer requests.
Thank you. We will be heading south Wednesday of next week. We drove up in a Volkswagen Rabbit assembled in Mexico. I'm 63, my wife is 62. We've been serving the Lord for 40 years and we have no plans whatsoever to retire. But our children are telling us, and the Lord is telling us, and common sense is telling us, that some of our activities will have to change. Perhaps we will take just a little bit of a different direction. So, prayer requests would be for local believers, especially the elders in assemblies in the state of Puebla, which is where we've been ministering the most. There are at least 20, 24 assemblies that have good fellowship and meet once a month for a men's Bible study. We have conferences. There's tremendous growth, tremendous potential there. Pray for the Mexican leadership in assemblies in Mexico. Much of the work now is in their hands, just about all of it, and they have been doing very well. They have been doing surprisingly well. Our specific ministries, we are starting to turn them over to people. We have a bookstore that's the legal umbrella for all our Emmaus publications. Any of you who have been abroad know what I mean by a legal umbrella. That has been turned over now to one of my daughters and her husband. He was a salesman for a Mexican industrial steel company in Monterrey. He resigned in June, and pray for him. He's a tremendous salesman, loves people, dedicated Christian, and I think he can take the ministry that we've started, he can take it farther along and much better than what we've been doing. So we will be relinquishing that to him. We will probably spend most of our time now in something we have not done much of before, visiting other assemblies in Mexico. We would like to do a lot more writing, so pray that the Lord would help us to use well whatever number of years he has in store for us in the future.
Thank you, Ron. We've appreciated this time. I'm sure it's been informative and helpful to all of us. And so now we'll just conclude this interview and turn the program back to our chairman.